This is Mayo Clinic Talks, a curated weekly podcast for physicians and healthcare providers. I'm your host, Andy Herber, a physician assistant in hospital medicine at Mayo Clinic's Rochester campus. Calcium disorders are commonly encountered in patients. Optimal management of hyper and hypocalcemia is imperative, as mismanaged can have lethal consequences. This podcast will do a quick review of the management of calcium disorders. Today, we're joined by Dr. Mira Kettis, a Mayo Clinic nephrologist, associate professor of medicine, and highly decorated educator. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Kettis.
It's a pleasure as always, Andy.
So today's electrolyte, we've covered sodium, we've covered potassium. Today's electrolyte is calcium. Why should we even care about calcium?
You know, calcium is one of those unique electrolytes, if you would. And part of it is because there's quite a bit of overlap with endocrine organs. And oftentimes, nephrologists and endocrinologists work together to figure out calcium problems. So this is one of those gray zone areas because there's overlap in specialties and understanding of calcium metabolism. Now, if you recall from my prior podcast, you know, I mentioned that, you know, hyponatremia and hyperkalemia are probably the two most common electrolyte disorders you'll see in the hospital setting and get consulted on. We don't get consulted about calcium problems as often. And I think part of it is it perhaps is maybe more intuitive, or it's easier to react to calcium disorders. You see a low calcium, you go ahead and treat it. There are tons of calcium supplements over the counter. It's not a hard one to come up with the solution to fix. And then if you have really high calcium, that's often when we get involved as nephrologists in the care to try to figure out how best to optimize the treatment and how to work up the process. So why should we care about calcium? In the way that potassium affects cardiac function, believe it or not, calcium also affects cardiac conduction and can lead to arrhythmia. But if you think of it from main principle, calcium is needed for neuromuscular function. You'll be able to appreciate perhaps some of the symptoms that may occur when you have alterations in calcium. So why should we care? Because alterations in calcium can lead to a wide range of abnormalities, and of biggest concern are those that relate to neuromuscular complications, whether that related to muscles or cardiac function.
So hypercalcemia probably gets the most coverage as far as getting people excited. What causes hypercalcemia, or what are your, you know, most common causes, I should say?
So when you think about causes of calcium disorders in general, I think it's helpful to step back and just understand the normal physiology. Because if you understand normal physiology, the rest becomes very intuitive. So where is calcium in our body? Well, 99% is in your bones. So keep that in your mind, because if you've got a bone destroying disease, you've got a source of calcium coming out that may be the explanation for your calcium disorder. So that's number one. I think the second thing to be mindful about is the fact that when you have the calcium that you actually have in your circulation, 50% of it is actually bound. So what do I mean by that? The calcium that actually has end organ effect is the ionized form. So what is it bound to? It's bound to albumin. It's bound to protein. So whenever you get a lab and you see a calcium alteration, really your first reaction before you think about treatment or even think about working it up, the first step should be, what's the albumin level in this patient? And then in your mind, you want to go ahead and think through, okay, for this albumin level, is this total calcium appropriate or inappropriate? Is it high or low? And there are lots of calculations out there. There's really one main formula that helps you adjust for that. So just remember that most of your calcium is in your bones, not in your blood, and that 50% of what's circulating is actually bound to albumin. So it's really important to keep in mind what the total albumin is when you try to understand if there is a calcium disorder present or not. Now, your question was about high calcium. I want to take you back to a mnemonic that I have no idea why I still remember it. I've been in medical school a long, long time ago, But to this day, I still remember the mnemonic, and I don't know why, but it says moans, groans, and psychic overtones. And it's supposed to depict a picture of someone who's, there's some generalized slowing, altered, complains of abdominal pain. They tend to be constipated. They just don't feel good. And they're maybe concerned that there's a psychiatric illness that's undiagnosed or untreated. So that's often how they actually present. And as I mentioned to you, calcium affects your neuromuscular function. So when you have too much calcium, believe it or not, you kind of shut down your neuromuscular excitability. It's actually decreased. So folks can have altered mental status, like I talked about, the generalized slowing. And part of the reason nephrologists get involved early on with hypercalcemia is because hypercalcemia causes kidney injury. Now, you may think, well, why would that happen? Well, because too much calcium, maybe kidney stones. And that's true. It does put you at risk for kidney stones. But even before there's time for stones to form, the biggest concern is that calcium vasoconstricts. And when it does that, it reduces perfusion to the kidney. So it kind of gives you a picture of almost like a pre-renal acute kidney injury. So oftentimes people come in with abnormal kidney function, and that's really where we're involved in their care. There are other reasons why calcium can affect the kidneys. I won't talk about it right now, but if you're interested, it can make you very dehydrated. High calcium makes you pee too much, and that can bring you in dry. That's why most people, when they have hypercalcemia, they're quite dry. So going back to, okay, the causes of high calcium. So remember, the storage is in the bones. The three main organs that are involved are going to be bones, gut, and kidney. And the main hormones that are the main players are going to be parathyroid hormone, vitamin D, and then calcitonin. And everything is going to be in balance. And I think one of the beautiful things about endocrinology, that there's always a negative feedback. The normal physiology, calcium is up, the other hormones are going to be shut down. Calcium is down, other hormones will be up. So everything tries to work in harmony to maintain normal balance. So the most common cause, and that's again kind of been the old dogma, I think continues to be the most common cause of high calcium in an inpatient setting, we always think malignancy. The most common cause of high calcium in an outpatient setting, it would be a parathyroid abnormality. And typically, you can distinguish that because a parathyroid adenoma, for example, you can get high calcium, but boy, the calcium level would be nowhere as high as you would get from a malignancy-associated hypercalcemia. So relatively, the hypercalcemia is not as profound as you can see it with malignancy.
You brought up something that I have a question on. So what do you say to the providers who are like, you know what, I don't want to do extra math. I don't want to go to MedCalc. I'm just going to order an ionized calcium. You talked about calcium and albumin versus ionized calcium. Is there a time where you would order one versus the other?
Great question. I think you have to think about your resources and where you are and how accessible a lab draw is. If you have an albumin level and you have a total calcium reported, which is commonly reported in any basic metabolic panel, I would say go ahead and just do the calculation. It's pretty easy. You know, it's corrected calcium. If you want to memorize it, some people do. It's essentially what you measure, the measured calcium, and then you add 0.8 multiplied by 4 minus serum albumin. But let me give you a caveat, and which I think is appropriate. You're not going to get a serum albumin and a BMP, right? So a basic metabolic panel is not going to have an albumin. So you're thinking, do I have the person come in for another redraw just for the serum albumin, or might as well just do an ionized calcium? I think in that situation, to me, it makes more sense to just go ahead and get an ionized calcium than just another draw for albumin. But if you've got the liberty to add on, you may be able to add on an albumin a lot easier than you would an ionized calcium.
Perfect. Thanks. So we talked about like common causes of hypercalcemia. We talked about the symptoms of hypercalcemia. How would an outpatient provider, so they get that elevated calcium, is there urgency to manage that? Can they just refer to somebody else, or what should they do if they see an elevated calcium?
This is so important. I think that helps you create what your thresholds of freaking out ought to be when you have high calcium. So in general, if your calcium is 1.0 point above the upper limit of normal. So we're talking upper limit of normal, different labs will have different reference ranges, but in general, it's about 10.1 or so, or 10.2. Let's say you're going to go up to 11. Okay. Well, at that point, you can start thinking through it. Okay. Well, this is odd. Why do I have a high calcium? Let me check out the albumin, right? Or maybe you want to get an ionized calcium. Is this real, right? Is this related to the amount of protein in my blood, or is this truly an elevation in my ionized calcium? So that would be your first thought process. The second one would be, okay, what could be driving that? And then you can start off in a stepwise fashion. And as I told you, the primary hormone is parathyroid hormone. So you could start by just saying, let me check that PTH, let me check the vitamin D, and these would be your very basic evaluation and workup. In the meantime, you can tell your patient, yeah, I want you to hydrate. And if you're in any calcium supplements, maybe let's hold off for a little while until we figure out what's going on. So number one, at one point above the upper limit normal, I wouldn't worry to escalate care to admission, for example, or something more aggressive, but I would confirm it. Number one, always confirm. Number two, if it's real, then you can do a basic workup by looking at the parathyroid hormone level and your 25 vitamin D, and learn from your patient, you know, how much vitamin D supplementation they're taking, how much calcium supplementation they're taking, for example, and then use that first set of data to decide, do you need to escalate to more testing, or you have your answer or not. Now, if your calcium level is well above 12, and I've had it, I'm going to be honest, I've had some patients in my clinic where the calcium is above 12, where I am a little uncomfortable with that. So at that point in the game, in my opinion, you want to look for complications, right? So if I'm already seeing the patient has renal injury because of the hypercalcemia, I may be more inclined to say, hey, you know, we may need to give you some IV fluids. And if the patient is hemodynamically stable, sometimes I can set that up in the outpatient setting rather than send them to the emergency room. But again, I've already started my workup. I'm starting to figure out where is this coming from. Now I'm worried that their calcium level is high enough that it's causing organ dysfunction. In this case, it would be the kidney. And I think it would be absolutely reasonable that if you're seeing acute kidney injury in the context of hypercalcemia, that would be a patient you may want to actually send them to the hospital and have that worked up a little bit in a more expedited fashion. So if it's only one point above, kind of again, that less than 12, I think you have some room. If you're seeing it higher than 12, or you're seeing renal injury that's not explained by anything else, but it's actually related to the hypercalcemia, then having more inpatient evaluation would be reasonable.
All right. We talked about, you know, medications, like people, I feel like everybody's on vitamin D and everybody's on bottles of Tums. Are there other medications that can cause serum calcium to go up? For some reason, I remember, or I feel like I was taught hydrochlorothiazide is on that list, or yeah. Is there other meds?
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. So of really all the diuretics that we have, only the thiazide classes. So it's not just hydrochlorothiazide. It could be chlorothalidone. It could be indapamide, not as commonly used, but very effective antihypertensive medications, and they fall within the same class of thiazides. So all thiazides really work to contribute to hypercalcemia. And there's a couple of thought processes about why that occurs. There is a thought that maybe they directly increase the calcium absorption in the kidney, or perhaps the way where they block in the kidney and the other parts of the nephron that are responsible for calcium absorption, the way the balance occurs favors more calcium reabsorption. And the flip side to that, Andy, even though it can be associated with hypercalcemia, it's oftentimes used to treat hypercalciuria. So people who have high urine calcium, which is common in more than 50% with kidney stone patients, giving them a thiazide diuretic works perfectly by reducing the amount of calcium in their urine. And in return, you could start seeing some elevation of calcium in the blood. I think one unique thing about thiazides is that you're never going to have hypercalcemia to the same level that you will see with malignancy, for example, or from a primary hyperparathyroid disorder. So it's going to be very mild, you know, may get close to that one point above the upper limit of normal, but quite often will be less than that. And I tell my patients when they're on thiazides, this could happen. I'm not worried about it. As long as I keep it in that, you know, one point above the upper limit of normal, will continue the same. I would not change your treatment course. I would call that as a benign cause of hypercalcemia.
Fantastic. So, you know, you mentioned malignancy and you mentioned bone destruction. Isn't there another way that you can get hypercalcemia from malignancy that's outside of like having lytic bone lesions?
Yes, absolutely. There are a couple of ways cancer can cause high calcium. So the direct bone invasion, so you can think of all your aggressive high tumor burden diseases, metastatic lung cancer or breast cancer, where there's extensive bone involvement. And classically, obviously, multiple myeloma, right, where you have those lesions within the bone. So hypercalcemia is part of your crab mnemonic when you think about disease defining and organ complications that define the presence of multiple myeloma. Now, the two other ways cancer can contribute to high calcium. One is by the expression of too much active vitamin D. So let me back up a little bit. And how, remember how I told you the main players were parathyroid hormone, vitamin D, and calcitonin? Well, there are two main forms of vitamin D in your body. One is the form that you would, you know, get from the sun, or you can get from diet or supplementation. That's that 25 vitamin D. The form of vitamin D that is more active, although both of them have biological activity, but the one that is most active, if you would, is called the 125 vitamin D. And in order to be converted from 25 all the way to 125, you have to have a very special enzyme, which we as nephrologists always brag about. It's, where is it? It's in the kidney. The kidney is an endocrine organ, believe it or not. And so that's fine and great. That's normal physiology. But there are some malignancies that express that enzyme. And there are actually other diseases that do that as well. So whenever you have a granulomatous disorder, all right, it could be sarcoid, it could be TB, even Crohn's. Whenever you have a granulomatous disorder, that granuloma has the ability to express that enzyme that converts the 25 to the active form called 125. Similarly, malignancies, particularly lymphomas, also learn to express that enzyme that allows you to have more of the active form of vitamin D. So what's the big deal about having an active form of vitamin D? It does a lot of things in the body, but the primary site of action is going to be in the gut. So it's going to want you, any calcium you bring into your diet, it's going to absorb as much as possible. So it does that. There are other effects on the kidney where it will promote more calcium absorption by the kidney as well. And so we talked about direct bone destruction. We talk about the expression of the enzyme that converts to the active form of vitamin D, causing you to absorb more of it in the gut, absorb more of it in the kidney. And then the third, which perhaps the most rare, and I'm going to be honest, I rarely see that in clinical practice. Perhaps my endocrine colleagues may see that more often, but I see a lot of the bone invasion, a lot of the active form of vitamin D. But the PTHRP, so it's essentially a hormone produced by a malignancy that has similar effects to PTH, but does not follow the same negative feedback loop inhibition that a parathyroid gland normally would. And there are some cancers that can be associated with that PTHRP, and it's a lab that you can actually check. So if you're getting to the point where you check your PTH, you check your vitamin D, and you're still hunting, this is not a PTH-mediated process, this is not a vitamin D-mediated process, then the next step really would be to think about your PTHRPs, look at a bone scan, or even check a 125 vitamin D level.
All right. On the other electrolyte talks, we kind of had that threshold, like I can manage this outpatient versus this patient needs to go to the hospital. Is there a number on calcium that you're pretty nervous that this patient needs to go to the emergency room or be directly admitted to the hospital?
So if there is renal injury and you've got a calcium 12 or higher, I think that's a fair case to send to the hospital setting. Now, we've had folks, you know, referred to the hospital at 16 or 14, some crazy numbers, and absolutely those patients are in the right place at the right time. So there are some patients who may not have renal injury And they've been kind of hanging out at a calcium of 11, you know, maybe up to 12. Again, a lot of that will depend on, okay, so you're stable, you're hemodynamically stable, blood pressure is okay, you're not showing me symptoms that, you know, you're not having ECG changes, you're not showing symptoms that I'm concerned about that can cause imminent harm. Can I navigate that in the outpatient setting? So I think 12 is a reasonable cutoff to consider admission. And absolutely, yes, if it's accompanied by a renal injury.
All right. So up in the Midwest, I feel like we have everybody on vitamin D. Is there a relationship to vitamin D, too much vitamin D supplementation and calcium balance?
Great question. And we really kind of saw an epidemic of that during the pandemic, right? Where everybody was taking vitamin D to protect against COVID or help them manage COVID. And they were taking really high doses. And believe it or not, Indy, a lot of those patients I got to experience, not because of a referral for hypercalcemia, but it was because of a referral of kidney stones. They end up too much calcium and they ended up with kidney stones, and you back off on the vitamin D and their urine calcium gets better. Now, I think it's important to recognize that we have such an amazingly intricate interplay of different hormones to keep things in balance. So it's not often that one change is going to have a big imbalance. So what do I mean by that? Too much vitamin D. So a little vitamin D at low doses, you know, 800, maybe up to even 2000 units per day. These are good levels that can promote bone building. Okay. And then if you go to 4,000, up to 10,000 or more, you actually have more bone resorption than bone building. And so the higher the doses, there may be an adverse consequence on your bones. And the downstream effect, the first manifestation before you actually see any kind of hypercalcemia would probably be too much calcium in the urine. That's your own body trying to compensate for all the excess calcium by allowing you to pee it out. But you can imagine if there's some element of renal impairment, for example, or a problem with your parathyroid hormone function, that you could potentially see vitamin D, excessive vitamin D supplementation contributing to high calcium. And you may even see the calcium high. We're not talking about 12, 14, 16. We're talking about your calcium is closer to 11. There's no reason for you to have calcium that high. How much vitamin D supplementation are you on and how long? So just recognize that the doses of vitamin D have different impact on bone health. And I'm not talking about in the context of somebody who's vitamin D deficient. I'm just talking about folks that do vitamin D on a regular basis, or they have adequate stores, but they're going above and beyond.
Great. So we talked a lot about hypercalcemia. Definitely gets the most press and the most excitement, but hypocalcemia has dangers too, right?
Absolutely. And it's probably one of the funner ones to teach for our medical students because it has some unique physical exam findings. You may remember that from the golden days, a Trosu's sign, where you have involuntary flexion of your wrist muscles and your fingers. They essentially start flexing involuntarily when you start inflating a blood pressure cuff on your arm. There are a bunch of videos on that on YouTube that you could watch, and you may have seen that in practice. And just muscle twitching if you tap on your facial nerve. So right around above, right in front of your auditory canal, and if you start tapping, you could start seeing some involuntary facial muscle twitching called the Shvosky sign. Both of them are associated with hypocalcemia. Or just people may kind of have perioral numbness or tetany or just muscle twitching. So these are things to look for in somebody who has symptomatic hypocalcemia. And the biggest concern, obviously, you can get prolongation of the QT interval and you can have a low seizure threshold. So hypocalcemia definitely has adverse impact, again, the neuromuscular system. So remember what we talked about with the main players, right? Parathyroid hormone, the vitamin D. How might someone get low calcium level? Like, what would drive that? Well, it could be that somebody had their parathyroid hormone taken out and, you know, they didn't have lab follow-up and all of a sudden they have really low calcium balance. So it could be a parathyroid-related problem. There are some genetic diseases where the normal feedback loop doesn't really work very well. There may be a mutation in the calcium sensing receptors in the parathyroid gland. And then perhaps the most common one in clinical practice, if you were to ask me what's the most common reason somebody may have low calcium, it really will probably be vitamin D deficiency. And whether that from dietary deficiency, it could be a malabsorption. If you remember, your fat soluble vitamins are your A, D, E, K. Well, there's your D, and you really do need D to be able to absorb calcium in the gut. So that's really important to have. And so any disease process that gives you fat malabsorption could be pancreatic insufficiency. It could be some of your bariatric surgeries, for example, like your gastric bypass surgery, perhaps. Those patients would be very prone to vitamin D deficiency, and a consequence of that would be a low calcium level. And then we obviously, as a nephrologist, you know, I'd be remiss not to mention that you will get low calcium in the context of renal failure from a variety of reasons. And so that's something that can be often seen in renal failure.
So you have low calcium and it's confirmed low calcium with albumin, because I know sometimes you can get pseudo hypocalcemia if the albumin mismatch. Do you treat everyone with low calcium, or do you only treat people if they're symptomatic? Is there any recommendations on that?
Yeah, great question. Patients who don't have a parathyroid gland, they need calcium. They need calcium supplementation, because you know they're really dependent on the oral replacement, vitamin D replacement. They don't have that parathyroid to keep calcium in check anymore. Patients with renal failure, our threshold to treat is a little bit higher, meaning that we don't rush to treat it unless patient is symptomatic. I don't have a cutoff in mind to share with you, but I can tell you from clinical experience, we tolerate a lower calcium. And part of it is we are very, very careful about calcium supplementation in renal failure patients, because they tend to have a lot of vascular calcification. They already have a lot of calcium phosphorus deposits and everywhere. And so you don't want to add fuel to the fire. So you kind of tread lightly. You don't try to aim for a calcium of 9 or a calcium of 10. But ideally, you want it above that 8.8 level. So I think the context would be important in terms of calcium supplementation, what the underlying disorder is. And if you've got somebody who's vitamin D deficient, just give them vitamin D. Their calcium will get better. They'll absorb it better from the gut.
All right. Well, because you brought it up and you're a nephrologist and you like all these salts, sometimes we see high phosphorus, right? And so high phosphorus will drive a low calcium. So is there an order in which you treat that? Do you fix the phosphorus first, or do you fix the calcium first, or does it change for everybody?
Andy, you speak like a true nephrology hero. You always go after the phosphorus. I tell my learners that phosphorus is the root of all evil and kidney failure. So phosphorus, phosphorus, phosphorus. That's where everything bad happens. Starts with the inability to excrete phosphorus. The downstream effects of that are your low calcium, low vitamin D, high PTH, all sorts of things. And so it's absolutely critical to recommend a low phosphorus diet. It's really is kind of the mainstay treatment early on. And then if that's not good enough and you're starting to see the parathyroid hormone go up, calcium go down, then you may start trying to think about other things. Whether it be a FOS binder, or sometimes we give the active form of vitamin D called calcitriol. So that's a prescription strength to try to correct some of the abnormalities that occur downstream to the high phosphorus. So in general, and it's a kind of a complicated question, because in general, the body does such a great job keeping your phosphorus level normal until your GFR drops, typically in that stage 4, right? When your GFR is less than 30 and going downhill. But up until then, your body's working so hard to keep your phosphorus level normal. And it's doing that at the cost of a bunch of other things happening in the background. Just to simplify it, if you have someone with a high phosphorus, low calcium, high PTH, in the context of renal failure, low phosphorus diet, or low phosphorus binders, sometimes you have to do both. You start with that first. You may still eventually need something else to correct the calcium. And then that next step would be the active vitamin D. Again, the using calcium supplementation has really gone out of favor in renal patients because of the concern for vascular calcification.
This has been fantastic once again. If you had to do your 1 minute summary for outpatient providers on calcium disorders, just to kind of recap your most important points for the last, you know, 20 plus minutes, what would you say?
I would say when you see an abnormality in your calcium on a basic metabolic panel, always look at your albumin and take the less than 1 minute to calculate what the corrected calcium for albumin is. And that should be your first step before you react to pursue supplementation investigation. The second thing to think about is once you've verified there is a calcium disorder, checking a vitamin D and a PTH level are your first basic steps. And that will guide what your next steps are. And then the third step would be get a good sense of what they're taking, prescription and non-prescription medications, because that can help solve a lot of problems before, again, escalating workup to hunt for malignancies, for example.
Fantastic. We've been talking about calcium with Dr. Mira Kettis. Thanks for your time, Dr. Kettis. If you have enjoyed Mayo Clinic Talks podcast, please follow us for weekly content.